Opportunity cost. Once you realize that there's costs and benefits to everything you're doing, you realize life becomes a lot more complicated.
You're listening to Buff Speak, the official podcast of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. I am Dr. Nick Gerlich, your host, as we meet up with the thought leaders making an impact today. Last spring, I had a blast chatting it up with the economics faculty on a Buff Speak episode. You know, the dismal science, the subject that every Engler College of Business student must take not two, but three courses in order to graduate. There are a lot of intersecting supply and demand curves in our students' lives. But in the process of recording that episode, I became aware of one of my colleagues and his stream of research. Turns out it is not only one of my favorite topics within the field of economics, it's also one that has a lot of practical applications. Well, if you can dodge all the math, that is. That subject is game theory, and my guest today is Dr. Eric Hoffman, Associate and Pickens Professor of Economics. Welcome back, Eric. I have had a lot of fun learning more about your research in hallway chats, as well as interviewing you for a recent feature in the College of Business newsletter. Explain for us what game theory is and how you became interested in it.
Yeah, well, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me. Game theory is very simply a study of situations in which parties, each of whose decision affects the other party, how do they come to what we call equilibrium? So if what I do affects what you do and what you do affects what I do, then you get into this like cycle of back and forth behavior. And we can see this going on all around us if we really pay attention. And so game theory sort of formalizes that situation, and we ask, when does this back and forth behavior come to, when does the dust settle, for example? And that's what we call equilibrium. That's going to be the long run predictions of these types of scenarios.
Now, I know you've had good fortune in publishing your findings. Tell us about some of your more prominent journal publications.
So I guess maybe my most prominent, if we're just going by the rankings of the journals, if you were going, it's probably my Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization publication, also known as GEBO. I published that pretty early on in my career. Recently, I've had some in Economic Theory and Games and Economic Behavior, if you're familiar with those journals. I'm sure nobody is, but if you ever become interested.
I have them on my coffee table.
Oh, of course you do. Yes, yes. I get the monthly subscription. Yeah.
So what aspects of game theory did you study? And more importantly, what did you find out?
So maybe the most interesting from a popular point of view might be the work I did in what we call global games, which is a subfield of information economics. And the idea is, well, if you think of a bank run is a popular example in this field of study, where if an individual might have a tiny belief that the health of the bank is bad, then that might not be enough to generate a bank run. But what if I think that you think the bank is unhealthy? Well, then I think that you're going to run on the bank, which is going to induce me to also run on the bank, and so on and so forth. So a kernel of a piece of information can, just by my beliefs about your beliefs, about my beliefs, and so on, cause this information cascade to spread. And even though it might not be true, the question is, where is the threshold? When does a belief become prominent enough to cause widespread behavior, when in reality, it shouldn't have been enough if taken in isolation.
So how is game theory applicable to everyday life? I mean, is this something that the average person could or should understand? And if so, how do you as an academic explain it to them? Because, you know, not everybody has a PhD in economics.
Yeah, so game theory is, it's complicated because there's definitely an academic side to game theory, where it's all just people shuffling around algebra and things like that. But then there's also this very applied. Some of the more prominent examples would be the organ donor market. What's the most efficient way to do that? That was developed by an economist named Alvin Roth, who's completely changed the way the organ donor market, if you want to call that, works. Auction theory is completely driven by results in game theory, and we see auctions all over the place, from not just eBay, but every time a business is auctioning off some, you know, something, assets or whatever, right? So that sort of thing. And even if you, there's also evolutionary biology. If you want to study the competition between organisms in an environment, which ones will compete with one another and win and get a chance to spread their genes and evolve. So that's all game theory. And even from a more academic perspective, game theory is not really at this point in the field something that's completely separate from everything else. It sort of pervades economics entirely. So even if we look at the most complex macroeconomic models, they use game theoretic principles to build these things from the ground up. So it's something, it's a tool that basically all economists use, even if they are not aware of it.
Now, I've long heard that game theory is the underpinnings of a lot of reality TV shows like Survivor. And I was a huge fan of Survivor back when it started, around the year 2000 or so. I got sucked in really fast and loved watching how people forged alliances with other players. And the host of the show, Jeff Probst, he's been with the show since day one, has said many times in television interviews that the game is, it is a game. It's all about game theory. And he's no economist, that's for sure. Otherwise, he'd be a professor, I guess, as opposed to a reality show host. But he understands game theory and he sees it at play in that show. And for those who are not familiar with Survivor, basically you got a group of contestants who are thrown onto an island and there's no way off, basically, at least not as far as we can tell. And at the beginning of the game, the contestants form a couple of large teams, kind of like forming dodgeball teams back in grammar school PE classes. But then later in the game, after people have been voted off the island, it becomes a solo game, and the goal is to be the sole survivor and win the money. Can you explain the tactics that a contestant might use throughout a game like this to forge alliances that could be useful for bettering their chances of survival? Because remember, at the end of the day, they're selfish. They want to win the money, and yet they still have to form some strategic partnerships along the way.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not a watcher of the show, but from what you describe, I think it can be easily applied. I'd have to look more into the details if you wanted a more in-depth answer. But it seems like these contestants have to sort of strike a balance between choosing partners, which are going to be strong enough to get them into the second round, but also weak enough for them to beat in the second round. And right. And so where does the game theoretic aspect come into this? It seems like you have to, you know, find groups and pairs to compete in the first round and then transfer on to the second round if you win. And let's just take an example. Let's suppose that I'm a medium strength player and you see me pair with a weak player, for example. Now, let's suppose you're a strong player. Would you rather pair with a weak player or a medium strength player? Well, you don't want to pair with a strong player because even pairing with a medium strength player, you're going to defeat us easily, and you don't want to have to face that strong opponent in the second round. So it depends on which groups form and so on and so forth. So it's a very complicated situation, but that's definitely in the realm of game theory.
I've also thought that even here in the ivory towers of academe, there's room for game theory, at least to some extent. Although there are no sole winners in this game, there are still winnings, such as tenure and promotions. But it ends there unless you want to go into administration and work your way up the ladder and get the nice office in Old Main, I guess. Throughout my career, I have forged research partnerships that leverage our respective strengths. At the same time, it was beneficial for all of us because publications beget tenure and promotions. But this was not about implicitly using someone like you might see on a game like Survivor, because the outcomes were good for all. There's not one person winning the $1 million or the tenure or the promotion or whatever. We can all benefit from this. Is this a somewhat diluted form of game theory?
No, this is not a diluted form of game theory at all. This would fall into the realm of game theory, which we call games on networks. Now, networks can mean a whole variety of things, but in this context, if you think of individuals as nodes on a network, or the where links connect, for example, then a game on a network is going to simply be which links do people choose to form between the nodes, or in this context, how do people choose their co-authors? And there's going to only be so many that you can that you can choose, of course, and you have to weigh the strengths and the benefits of making a connection. Obviously, there's going to be a saturation point. You can't have, well, there's this debate. We won't get into it. You can't have 75 co-authors, presumably. People like to push that boundary now and then. But I found that after three co-authors, the marginal benefit starts to outweigh the cost of. And so then you can think of this game, right? We all want to partner with the strongest author, but they also want to find co-authors, and they have a saturation point, and which nodes form over there are going to affect what options are available to me, and so on. So that's definitely in the realm of game theory, and that's something we call network games.
In the corporate world, though, I can definitely see this more traditional game theory playing a role as a person does whatever it takes to build their strategic relationships, all in the name of furthering their career and theirs only. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this would go back to what I just said about network games. And this goes to Facebook and social media as well. This is how game theory addresses these phenomenon, is which connections do people choose to make? And we can cast this in whatever sort of flavor we want, whether it be the benefits of co-authoring and getting tenure, or the benefits of climbing the political ladder. So this would all fall under that category.
Yeah, but there's a singular victory to be had here in the corporate world, because unless it's one of those rare companies with co-CEOs, only one corner office, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but before you get there, everybody's competing and stabbing each other in the back, right?
Yeah, definitely stabbing.
You're on top, you have to stay on top. So.
Yeah, of course. Okay. So really, what this does for me is it raises a simple question in my head. Is game theory something that we as humans are just wired to do, with or without all the math and theory? Do we just do this?
We could have an entire podcast just on this topic. It's fascinating. We start delving into the philosophical here. I like to always, when people ask this, I always like to bring up the quote from Milton Friedman, who, famous economist from Chicago, who said, well, he's a very big math econ guy, and he developed a lot of the theories that we use today. And he was once asked this question, and his response was, you know, if the theory is good, then it's like observing participants playing a game of pool or billiards, is the way he put it, right? The pool player doesn't calculate the sines and the cosines and the trigonometric angles that you have to shoot. They just get up there and they shoot the ball and it goes in the hole. But if you were to model this correctly, you would definitely have to incorporate all this nasty math, right? And so the question is, can you capture behavior in such a way such that even if the underlying actors or consumers or players in the games or whatever we're talking about, it just captures their behavior, just like a ball bouncing off of the side of the pool table without having to do the math. And that's essentially what economists do.
So basically, every good or bad action can be rationalized in the name of self-interest. And I realize I'm sounding like Milton Friedman here, but isn't that what capitalism is all about anyway?
Yeah, I'd have to ask you what you mean by that. But in terms of when I teach rational behavior in my principles course, what I have to emphasize is that economists don't mean rationality in the way that the general public means. When we think of rationality and we talk about this in common everyday language, we're talking about, oh, did this person make a stupid decision, or that wasn't rational. We essentially equate, you know, was this a stupid decision or not, right? In economics, what we say is all that is required to take a rational action is for me to choose the best action based off of my beliefs. So from your perspective, what I might be doing that looks stupid to you could be perfectly rational from my perspective because maybe you have more information than I do. And so from that perspective, it almost becomes synonymous with just everyday behavior, because presumably you're promoting your self-interest based on the information that you have. So that's what we mean by economic rationality.
Well, rationalizing and being rational are two very different things.
Sure.
Rationalizing is just a mental process, I guess, where you're trying to make sense of something. Mm-hmm. And of course, that whole idea of being rational, mm-hmm. I try to shoot that down in my consumer behavior class a lot too. We say mm-hmm. we're trying to be rational and making very sound, informed decisions, but then we don't.
Yeah, right. Well, no, I mean, there's an entire field of economics that tries to deal with these mental blocks that prevent us from acting in a perfectly, math-based way. And we can deal with that stuff, but that's an entirely separate subject.
Well, unfortunately, there are some limitations to game theory. We're not as rational. Well, I'll be careful with that word, as we might like to be, even though rationality, and let's just define it as always seeking what is the best possible solution, which probably is going to be in terms of self-interest too. That's a key assumption in a lot of economic modeling. It's a key assumption in consumer behavior theory, that's for sure. How do you account for the problems in modeling human behaviors when it's so difficult to isolate or even define all the factors and variables that may influence a person's strategy?
Yeah, I mean, this comes down to modeling in general, and it's not just a challenge that economists face, but physicists and engineers. And I mean, for example, an engineer can't calculate the exact gust of wind and all these things. So you try to capture these things in broad, simple models. So the hope in economics, at least, is can you write down something that makes sense, that you know captures the main thrust of people's beliefs and desires and what they want in their lives? And then once you write down this model, then you put it to data and you say, does this make sense? Does it explain a good amount of data? And if it does, then you have a good model on your hands. And so from there, we can say, well, can we fine tune this? Are we taking all these factors into account? And then if so, can we explain more data? We're never under the assumption that we're going to explain every variable in the world and capture it into a model. That's unrealistic, not just for economics, but for any field of science.
One of the things I did years ago on my dissertation was to use the mathematical model I built with the data that I used to build the model to see how well it predicted itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I got lucky. It was like 93%.
Wow.
I was like, well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But imagine if the National Weather Service took all their data from this last hurricane, Hurricane Helene, and the terrible devastation that it wrought. Not just in Florida, but all the way up into the Carolinas. And imagine if they took all the past data, which obviously has now happened, it's behind us, and then ran it back through the models they were using to try to predict its path. Do you think it would have predicted the same thing, or would it have sent the hurricane somewhere else?
That's a great question. And it comes down to also the fact that there's an economy of model building too, because you have only so much time and intellectual fuel that you can put into trying to cook up a certain model. And there's costs and benefits. So if we can have a simple model that explains a lot, then of course we can always add more to the model. But if we only explain 1% more of the data, then you have to ask yourself, is this more complicated model? Does that bring us actually more utility and understanding to the world? And so
are there any other aspects of game theory that you are currently researching or plan to research?
Yeah, so it comes back to, I think, what you asked previously about this concept of rationality. And one of the biggest things that fascinated me about game theory when I first was introduced to it, and I talked about this concept of equilibrium and where does the dust settle, right? And so we can write down these models. And we can say, oh, this is the mathematical solution to this model. And then we say, okay, that's fantastic. If we all lived in a in an AI world with robots, that would work perfectly. But how do real people, flesh and blood people, come to behave according to this abstract mathematical concept? Even if they can't divide two numbers properly, why should we expect them to behave according to this model? And so some of what I've done in the past and a lot of what I'd hope to do in the future is show, and it's been shown in the past, but we can show this in other contexts as well, that if people are given enough opportunity to learn the environment that they're dealing with, they come to learn to play these, what we call equilibrium, even if they don't know the model that they're involved in.
Now, let me ask you a question about how I run my classes, and I bet other professors do similarly. We do a lot of group projects, naturally. That's one of our stated objectives here in the Engler College, to promote teamwork. It's an important skill, and it's something that's hard to teach. You just do it, and you learn by doing it. And early in the semester, like the first week, I require my students to form their own teams rather than use a random name generator and just let the pieces fall where they may. I let the students figure out with whom they wish to forge alliances. But I tell them, you know, be strategic. Now, in the classroom, it's a little easier because they have FaceTime with each other and maybe they know each other from previous classes. But in the online arena, it's a lot harder. They may not know anybody in the class, and they may never know anybody in the class, at least face to face. And the only mechanism I have is what I call the getting to know you board. The first week of the semester, it's kind of like Tinder, you know. You get up there, you know, put your profile out there, and people either swipe left or swipe right. And then they've got, you know, they've all got a week to figure it out and pitch proposals to other people. Hey, you want to be on my team and all that kind of stuff. What kinds of game theory do you see going on here? Or maybe I should phrase it a little differently. Mm-hmm. Let's make this advice for the students. What should they be doing?
Ooh, that's a great question. What should they be doing? If I'm going to give an academic answer to this question, I need to know, you know, a lot more information about their preferences. And it's not about me offering advice as to what they should be doing. It's more about the economist's job is to sort of predict what sort of outcomes we should see at the end. Yeah, I would, just like in any sort of strategic situation, know what your preferences are and be, you know, observant of what everybody else is doing around you. And in that sense, you can probably, you know, work out what's going to work for you the best. A common misconception about game theory is if you take a game theory course, then you're going to be able to beat your grandma on Farkle or Yahtzee or something like that. And that's not necessarily how it works. Devising the best strategy in a given situation is, sometimes we can offer some insights there, but it's more about predicting what we see at the end.
Have you discovered any other limitations of game theory? I mean, is there any one aspect of human behavior that you think can't be explained by it?
Yes. And I mean, we can get philosophical here, but I believe that, and this depends on where you come down on the question of free will or not, right? Because when a physicist studies an electron in a vacuum, presumably that electron just does what it's built, if you want to use that terminology, to do. It does what electrons do, and it can't do anything else. Human being, on the other hand, even if I have a model of your brain and I say, well, this is what Eric's going to do today, can I really boil down my behavior in a deterministic manner the same way I can sort of a physical system? And I would say no. People might disagree with me on this, but I don't think we can model humans down as fundamentally as we can fundamental, you know, particles of physics. But where it does have bite and where it does work is when we start to aggregate and we start to look at large swaths of data, and we see that while you can't predict my exact decisions on this exact day at this exact minute and hour, if we take 100 people or 1,000 people and we look over a broad time span, then we can get pretty good predictive models.
When we come back, we're going to learn about Eric's backstory, how and why he came to WT, and his thoughts on economic education. I got questions. After all, wouldn't it be nice if everyone understood basic economic concepts? I know I have dreams of that day, but I doubt it'll ever happen. But still, it would make so much of our political debates a lot easier.
Life sometimes has a way of interfering with our university education. Marriage, family, work, any or all of these can cause us to hit the pause button on our degree, with hopes of one day finishing it. The only problem is that returning to campus can get a lot harder when you're no longer 20 years old. And that's precisely why we launched our online BBA, with majors in accounting, finance, general business, marketing, management, human resource management, and computer information systems. Available completely online. You can return to school without having to step foot on campus. Or maybe you want to transfer in from a two-year program elsewhere, but once again, are not able to attend face-to-face. Our online offerings are for you as well. We can help you finish your degree and climb higher on your career ladder, at your pace and in your time. We're AACSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WT BBA in hand. For more info, find us at wtmu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2525.
We've all got an origin story that explains the how, why, and when of arriving at a certain place. Eric, when did you come to WT and why did you choose us?
Oh, when did I come to WT? I'd have to, when was it, 6 years ago? Something like that. Well, I just graduated with my PhD from the University of Kansas. And like every other graduate, I was, looking for a job. I first wound up at a school in Memphis, Tennessee, where I took a visiting assistant position. I very much enjoyed that. But then halfway through the semester, I got a call from WT, who was offering me a tenure track position, which is a lot more valuable, if you will, than a visiting assistant professor position. And it's a funny story. I wound up leaving my class halfway through the semester at Memphis, and I sort of feel bad for that. But on the other hand, I got over it, right? Somebody there had to cover a course midway through the semester, but they should have offered me a tenure track job. What can you say?
That's right. Yeah, we win. So, what courses are you teaching these days, and are they on campus, online, or both?
Yeah, I usually teach a mix of online and on-campus courses. Right now, I'm teaching principles of microeconomics, both online. I'm also teaching intermediate macroeconomics, which is a course that, I'm not a macroeconomist, but I think that it's something that's fascinated me in bringing my perspective to the course. And I've actually learned a lot teaching that course. Teaching this subject to students who I think appreciate the value of macroeconomics and the understanding GDP and inflation and unemployment is something that struck me it's very important to sort of get it right in this course, because it's a lot of where a lot of misconceptions come from.
So do you find any challenges teaching a course like micro in the online arena? Because I remember from my undergrad and master's days, we didn't have online. We had chalkboards, not even dry erase boards. We had chalkboards. And the professor would have to, roll up his sleeves and draw all these demand curves and supply curves and marginal revenue curves and marginal cost curves and everything. But in the process, it made sense because we could see where he was going a step at a time. That would take a lot more development in my mind to be able to convey that in an online class, because the best I can visualize here's a static image, just look at it,
right?
Whereas I'm actually drawing in the classroom. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that was a challenge. Like I said, coming from my first job, I had never taught online before. So coming to WT was the first time that I was asked to teach online. And as a microeconomist, that was one of the things I'm thinking, okay, how am I gonna do this? Because it is very much calculation based and supply curves, demand curves. But luckily, For all of my courses, I make course videos in which I don't just show them, you know, slides and here's the answer, but they actually see my pen moving across the thing. And I think you might think, oh, well, that's just a waste of time. You know, just show me the picture, this is the end result. But I've always found that actually seeing the pen move across the screen sort of ingrains that in the student's mind. At least it did for me. Like you said, watching somebody actually do it instead of just seeing the end result is very helpful. So that's why I employ course videos for all of my online. And now I'm even my on-campus courses, I'm offering supplementary course videos.
Now, you've said twice now that you're a micro kind of guy, yet you're teaching a macro course. is anyone better than the other?
Yes, micro is a clearly better field.
Good answer. But why?
No, that's an old sort of back in graduate school, we'd always, you know, sit at different lunch tables, if you will, the micro and the macro people, and sort of a friendly rivalry. But no, just micro is just plainly a topic that just... you know, it just fascinates me to a different sort of degree. And even macroeconomic models. So if you think of, you know, physics, for example, you have the particles at the bottom, and then you have the cosmological models, the black holes and all that stuff on the large levels, or even the cells, right? But underlying this all is sort of the quantum fields and that kind of thing. But you build up from that and you get these larger level aggregate phenomenon. And micro is really that lower level basic, where everything, the ground level, if you will, and working on that ground level, sort of like working on the front line in some sense, is what fascinates me.
At the risk of sounding a little bit self-serving here, what is it that you like about WT? I mean, it looks like you've been here long enough now to have set down a taproot, and I'm using a metaphor here that they used with me back in the late 80s when I first came here. They told me that if you stayed long enough to wear out a pair of shoes, or probably more aptly, a pair of cowboy boots, that you would stay forever. How are your shoes holding up these days?
Well, I don't think well, first of all, I love it here. But I do have to admit, I don't think my next pair of shoes will be a pair of cowboy boots. I've not fully converted to that level of, you know, so to that point yet. But I definitely love it here at West Texas. I think one of the defining features, having taught at multiple places before, and I know this sounds cliche, but just the work ethic of the students and the ability, people are very polite, and just that willingness to learn. And again, these all sound, you know, cliche, you know, ask ChatGPT, say some nice things about students. But this is really my impression of the students here at WT.
It's no surprise that the economy is one of the top subjects as we go into the final stretch of the presidential election. I mean, it's coming up soon. Inflation and unemployment reared their ugly heads as we came out of the pandemic, but both have improved considerably, enough so that Fed Chairman Jerome Powell recently announced a 50 basis point reduction in the federal funds rate. He wanted to help what he thought was maybe a somewhat softening employment sector, but this is the first time the Fed has ever done a rate reduction this big since the year 2008. And if you remember 2008, those were not good economic times.
Financial crisis.
Yeah, we were in a world of hurt back then. But I don't think we're in as big of a world of hurt today. But who knows? I could be wrong. But judging by comments that I read on social media, which I know can be a dangerous thing, it seems that very few people have any understanding whatsoever of basic economics, from supply and demand to tariffs, the types of economic systems like, you know, what's socialism, communism, et cetera, taxes, you know, all the things. Does this frustrate you as someone who does know what these things are and can engage in hallway chit chat with any of us? And we all understand, but as soon as you get out in general public, seems like nobody really knows any of this. I mean, aren't these things preeminent truths?
Does it frustrate me? Actually, it doesn't frustrate me. And it's because I understand why. You know, unlike topics such as, for example, Japanese history, which doesn't really affect the daily lives of many people, They're more willing, I think, to defer to experts on these topics and just say whatever the field says, then that's probably somewhat approximation of the truth. But economics, unlike many fields, unlike most fields, affects people on a daily basis, right? And so in some sense, they're forced to form an opinion on what's going on around them, how they're, you know, what's impacting their job market and so on and so forth. And for example, if I were sitting down at Thanksgiving and my uncle said, quick, form an opinion on what happened in 1947 in Japan, it would sound like nonsense, right? But I'm being forced to form an opinion, just like everybody else out there is subconsciously forming an opinion on something that impacts their daily lives. And so it's not surprising to me that unless you've studied the topic, you're going to get it wrong, probably the first time or the second time. And that's why I love being a teacher here, teaching the field of economics, because you are able to confront a lot of these misconceptions and, you know, work it out.
So what do we do to try to solve this problem? I mean, it reminds me of the old Miller Lite beer commercials from the 80s and 90s. Tastes great. No, less filling. You know, and it became a tug of war. Well, it's the same thing. The far right wanting to, you know, we got to solve inflation. We got to solve unemployment. And the far left is saying, no, we got to tax more. And we can never really reach a level of mutual understanding or agreement, it seems like. Unless you've got a lot of time to study economics, you probably don't fully understand much of this. Yet at the same time, you more than likely know very well all the difficulties of making ends meet, which seems to be a very common refrain these days. Sometimes you just don't need theory to describe your reality.
I think you're right. I don't think you need to have a PhD in economics in order to understand the basic issues that we're talking about, especially on the, you know, talk about political level or things like that. And I don't want to get too political, but it does surprise me which side is espousing which economic policies just seems to switch, maybe not year by year, but certainly decade by decade. It's unbelievable for me to hear that one side wants to raise tariffs and raise money through tariffs. We've done that experiment. We did that 100 years ago, and it's a disaster, right? But now this is back up, right? And I think that if people were to understand how that works and understand just basic Econ 101, principles of micro, principles of macro, I think those little, you know, steps would exponentially, the benefit would be tremendous in just understanding the basic workings of the economy.
But do the media help or exacerbate the problem? I mean, if anyone's in a position to help answer questions and clear up confusions, it should be them. We've got this stuff piped into our living rooms. Pretty much every living room in America has access to the news media, either by streaming or cable or satellite or whatever. Yet I still see way too many people who think they know what socialism is. Basically, it's anything they don't like. Or maybe they think that deflation is a desired state and that prices are all going to come tumbling back down to earth one of these days, which I have my doubts there too, because wages have managed to catch up finally. And we can't go cutting people's wages now in order to bring about
not
price
a popular
deflation.
Move.
No, it's not a good one. And unemployment of 0%, is that an end goal? I mean, come on. When I was in school, we considered 6% unemployment to be full employment. And now a good target is 4%. And, you know, some people might think, well, that's terrible. 4% don't have a job. But economists at least seem to think that's okay. And what about the trade deficit? I mean, there are folks who think that's a bad thing. You know, we live by the railroad here. You can tell the heavy trains are all going east and the empty trains are going west. We're taking the empty shipping containers back to Long Beach and they send them back to China to load them up again. The problem is we just can't make everybody go to university. Our only hope is that they pick up the truth from the voices that they're listening to, but you can't always trust those voices.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of what you say there is true. Like, you know, I think when I teach my macro course and we talk about inflation, I think there is that conception of you know, zero inflation and that sort of thing is, but it's like, you know, if you were to go to a doctor, it's like, the pulse of a patient, right? If this person has zero pulse, that's not good, right? And so like inflation is sort of akin to that. You do want some low level of, it means your economy is still alive and kicking, right? So there's that whole separate topic there. But in terms of social media, I'm becoming less and less optimistic about the role of social media in society. And, you know, people want their biases confirmed in easy to grasp sound bites. And usually the truth is two or three deviations away from a simple truth. And the last thing somebody wants to do is have to work through a bunch of complicated arguments just to see at the end of the tunnel that they've been wrong the whole time. There's no incentive to do that. And so that's why I'm becoming less and less, you know, optimistic. I don't know. Do you have a solution to this?
I don't. I'm not an economist, so.
Well, I think this is a problem that goes just beyond, you know, being in economics. I think this is, you know, misconceptions in social media. You know, it's affecting all aspects of society.
Well, we let the genie out of the bottle about 20 years ago, and we're not going to get her back in.
I don't think so.
Our program here in the COB is rather unique among other colleges and schools of business in that we require a third econ class, which can be anything beyond the basic micro and macro. Is this a good way to help improve economics education? And if so, why do you think more schools don't require it?
It's a good question. I'd have to look at what other schools are doing and look at the statistics on that. And the answer I give is probably not going to be popular among all of my colleagues. But as an economist, I do think that economics is sort of foundational in the sense that even if you're taking a marketing class or you know, management class, I think, you know, having a good understanding of supply and demand, it drives just about everything. It's sort of the backbone of all of these sort of other business disciplines, as far as I see. And of course, if you brought somebody else in, they might differ. But I do think that there is a benefit to be had to being exposed to more economics.
One thing I've resolved not to do is try to correct people when I see them spout blatant economics falsehoods. I know it's tempting, but it would take up my whole day, and I don't have time to police my Facebook feed, you know, and go through and fix all this. My job is just to educate my current students, not everyone else on Facebook. But at the same time, who better to do it than people who actually know?
Yeah,
I mean, it might be our job after all to correct all the world's misconceptions. I mean, we are in a position to help wean people from the bottle of Dunning-Kruger, that intoxicating beverage of not knowing what you don't know, and then speaking as if you do.
I mean, I think this is part of the challenges of maybe something that you've previously mentioned with this whole social media environment. And I've seen too many academics go down this, I have to fight these online battles and prove that I'm right. And they get into this back and forth. And to me, it does nothing but sort of lowers their level of credibility because they are involved in the same back and forth, put it nicely, mud throwing contest as everybody else. And if you're just one of the other combatants then who are you, right? So I think we have to, you know, walk a fine line between setting out what we know about the certain topic, in this case economics, but also being able to engage, but engage in a way that doesn't degrade our own credibility.
When we come back, we'll look at Eric's future research plans and, well, maybe even his plans to help save the world with a better understanding of economics.
The demand for professionals in data analytics and information systems far exceeds the supply, which is why the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business developed the Masters of Science in Computer Information Systems and Business Analytics degree program. Already, external reviewers have ranked it among the highest IS programs in the nation. We are an AACSB accredited college and among the most elite business schools around the world. Available completely online, this program will help you transform businesses and propel them far into the 21st century. Data mining, data analytics, and data science are keys to your success, and we provide the key to unlock your future. Reach for the stars with a West Texas A&M Master's in Computer Information Systems and Business Analytics. For more info, find us at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2500. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
You're a young man still, Eric. Assuming you stay the course in academia, you probably got another 30 years left in you. What kinds of things would you like to be researching as well as teaching in the coming years? Or is there still enough work to do in game theory to keep you occupied for all this time?
There's always enough work to do in game theory. There's always enough work to do in any field if you really are observant enough to ask questions. There's always going to be new things to explore. My initial background was very much on the theory, math, equations, heavy calculus, and all this sort of stuff. That sort of thing, captured my imagination that we could describe human behavior with equations. But, I think in the future, if I were to say where I would like to see myself publish more, and that would be more on the experimental side, where we get individuals in laboratory settings and test these theories with real people and, confirm or disconfirm some of the theories that we're throwing out there. And the benefit of that is it also involves students as well. So I think that would be a nice convergence between, bringing the students into my field of research as well as doing something that I love.
The field of economics is one that seems to have very little change over time. I mean, micro is still micro. I mean, if I were to look at your micro textbook today, it's probably not much different from what I looked at in the late 1970s. Supply is still supply. Demand is demand. And there's not going to be any change to that. And much can be said the same about macro and all the other courses, like from international to money, credit, and banking, and so forth. But are there any new courses you think we need to add to our economics curriculum that we don't currently have, and why?
That's a good question. In terms of little changing over the field of economics, I think like any other field, the low-hanging fruit have been picked, right? We're not going to find I can't speak with certainty, but when Adam Smith started to describe, the basic supply and demand and that sort of thing, and the people who followed his line of thought, I don't know if we're going to have that sort of change in way of thinking. But even we mentioned the financial crisis, and I experienced that when I was in school. And when I was in graduate school, and the macroeconomists, the students as well as the professors were like, oh, no, we need to throw out all the textbooks. There's a phenomenon here that our models aren't capturing. And since then, they've done well to adjust and incorporate these new phenomena in their models. So things are always happening that challenge our current understanding at the time. So there's always going to be that. In terms of new courses, that's a great question. There's a difference between maybe what I'd like to teach and what would be most beneficial for the students. I'd love to get a pure game theory course in there or a mathematical economics course in there. In terms of, what might be best for the students, that's a discussion that we can have. But in terms of curriculum stuff, I'd have to really put a little more thought into that.
I mean, you've got plenty enough years ahead of you that you could be the next Danny Kahneman here. And even though he was a psychologist, he's known kind of as the father of behavioral economics. I mean, there's got to be something out there waiting for you to put your name on, right?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to win the Nobel. If I win the Nobel Prize, then sure. But I'm not. That's not necessarily my goal at this point. Who knows? Maybe tomorrow I'll scribble down the equation that explains everything, right? Who knows?
Just don't throw that napkin away.
No, exactly.
Of all the various majors we offer in the College of Business, economics usually seems to be at the bottom of the list among the fields chosen by our undergrads as their field of study. Why do you think this is so?
It's a very tricky question, and it's something that it's always kind of perplexed me, but, it is... a tad more challenging than some of the other disciplines. There we do, we're more algebra heavy. We try to, we have complex models in the whole nine yards. And I think that that can deter some people from thinking, a lot of people think, well, I'm not a math person. But, I think if economics is properly taught, then you don't have to be a math person to understand what we're doing in economics. I certainly wasn't when I was an undergraduate student. I got a C in college algebra, but don't tell anybody that. I think just it might be intimidating at first glance.
And yet, as we've discussed, it's a field in which our society is woefully undertrained. Is there anything that can be done to help turn this ship around?
No, I think it just comes back to, like I said, good teaching in the classroom, laying out the concepts, understanding the misconceptions, and trying to find, you know, a common ground with your students in terms of where their beliefs are. And you know their preconceptions are, and what you're trying to get through to them, and what can you get through to them in one semester. So, just having that sort of bigger picture view in mind, and just doing the best you can in the classroom.
If you had to guess the economic matters that we'll be talking about in 20 years, let's say it's the election of 2044. Will it still be inflation, unemployment, and the usual suspects? Or do you think something else is going to emerge as the topic du jour?
That's a good question, and I'm going to give the boring answer here. I do think it will still be inflation, unemployment, and GDP, and that sort of thing. I know that people are talking about, you know, AI and technology and all these things, and there's a sense that we have a fundamental, you know, we're living in the future now, right? The past is the past. Now we're in the, well, you know what? 15 years ago, we thought we were in the future as well. And 100 years ago, people thought they were in the future as well. So if history is anything to go by, then I think we'll still be talking about, you know, unless we have, you know, a disaster such as a big war or, you know, climate change and we're all swimming in the, you know, in the ocean now. So that will definitely change the game. But as long as something like that doesn't happen, then I think we're still going to be concentrating on the same old things.
And what can we all be doing to help in the area of economics education? I am convinced it is not so much the most misunderstood topic, but rather the least understood of all. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think things like what we're doing right now is bringing these what can be scary topics and boiling them down and using some of this new technology, like a podcast, like what we're doing. I know a lot of my colleagues, you know, do podcasts and they do blog posts and just sort of bringing these complex ideas down to the basic level where people can gain that confidence that this isn't as hard as I thought it was. And maybe I'll sign up for that economics course. And, you know, being mindful that we have to step out of the ivory tower, so to say, and package these things in a way that's consumable to the general population.
Well, my own colleagues in marketing may take umbrage with me, but when I'm advising my people, my stable of advisees, if they've got any electives left over, I don't tell them to take more marketing. I tell them to take more economics.
I'll keep my mouth shut on that, but I'm giving you a thumbs up behind the scenes.
Good. Yeah. Because I think economics helps explain everything. It's like knowing Latin or Greek.
Yeah,
you know?
sure.
Everything comes from that.
Yeah, I can't disagree.
So why is economics then known as the dismal science? I mean, it doesn't seem so dismal to me.
Yeah, and I think this goes back to maybe something I said earlier about the fact that people are forced to form an opinion about a complex topic. And, you know, the basic reaction is, oh, I hope this is not too hard. And then you find out that, you know, life isn't as simple as you'd like it to be. And so it's sort of a dismal outlook on, you know, what it requires to form educated opinions about the things that affect us on our daily lives. For example, like, you know, I like to watch, you know, sci-fi or science channels, and they talk about, you know, black holes and galaxies. And I can enjoy that kind of stuff on the popular level without having to worry myself about how it all, you know, works out on you know, mathematically. But, you know, economics, like I said, is something that impacts people in their daily lives. And just it can be overwhelming to fully grasp what's going on out there.
Lead us out the door, Eric. Give us your best shot and tell us, what are you doing to try to help save the world through economics?
Helping educate my students here at WT, where we offer more than BS in economics.
You've been listening to Buff Speak from the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. Our executive producer is Justin Lovell, and Allison Hunter is our associate producer. Our co-editors are Maverick Evans and Paul Torres. Lindsay Bjork is our Director of Marketing and Outreach Initiatives, which includes overseeing BuffSpeak. Dr. Jeffrey Babb is Director of Accreditation and is our technical consultant. Finally, Dr. Amjad Abdulat is Dean of the College. You can find us online at wtamu.edu/cob for more information about our programs. Be sure to check out our many academic offerings. Come for the quality, stay for the small classes, affordable tuition, and friendly, approachable professors. And look online at our faculty blog, profspeak.com, for more insights. You can listen to BuffSpeak on your favorite podcast portal, as well as on our website, buffspeak.biz. And if you like what you've been hearing, don't be afraid to share us with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth has always been the best form of advertising. Until next time, love one another. For the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, I am Dr. Nick Gerlich. And as always, go Buffs! BuffSpeak.